Hey everyone, welcome to Just Mental Health with Stefan M, the podcast where we discuss mental health through a social justice lens. I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie. A quick disclaimer before we get started, we are mental health professionals, but this is not to be taken as professional advice.
We are also aware that our privilege may cloud our perspective on some topics, and we not only welcome, but encourage you to message us with criticism and correction. Let's get started. Okay, our small business shout out is a dear friend and colleague of mine, Margaret Brooks Cox. It's her newly opened private practice. So we went to grad school together and have remained friends. And she's a really awesome person and a really great therapist. So she has a private practice in Louisville on Taylorsville Road. She works with families, children, adolescents, and adults in their healing journeys, combining clear goals, evidence-based methods for treatment, and compassionate care. She's committed to helping children, adolescents, adults, and families to achieve their goals and experience the journey of healing within a safe and supportive environment. The approach to her work as a psychotherapist with the greatest respect and humility for individuals, for individual differences, cultural backgrounds, religious beliefs, and social experiences. She celebrates the uniqueness of each individual, and as a result, treatment is tailored to unique needs. So she uses methods that are research and science-backed, such as EMDR. She's trained in EMDR. She offers a range of expressive therapies, including play therapy, sand tray therapy. She is a certified parent, nurturing parent facilitator. She's actually in the process of getting international certification in EMDR. So she looks like she takes a lot of insurance. So I'm looking at her Psychology Today page right now. So there is lots of information about her on there. Again, it's Margaret Brooks Cox. So look her up if you are in Kentucky. She does telehealth, so you don't have to actually be in Louisville. I highly recommend her. And now a quick ad.
All right, so we are back. And today we have another wonderful guest. We have Abbas Chinoy with us. And he is a first-generation American son to immigrants from India. He grew up with Jews in Skokie, Illinois, and he went to high school on the south side of Chicago and was later trained and educated by Jesuits. Abbas acquired a couple of master's degrees, just a couple, you know, from the University of Chicago in divinity and social work. So yeah, he has a master's in divinity and he's an LCSW. And if you listen to our podcast about what all of those letters at the end of people's names mean, you'll know that's a licensed clinical social worker. And he also works as a part-time lecturer at the School of Social Work. He is a chaplain turned therapist. And so he, before becoming a clinician, he did spiritual care and he was engaged in laboratory research. And just some fun facts about him, he also loves sci-fi, dogs, coffee, and flying kites. That's so interesting to me because I don't think I've ever flown a kite or known anyone who's
You've never flown a kite?
No.
Not even as a kid?
No. It's not really that windy in Kentucky, so you don't get a good, you know, so nobody really does it here. But anyways, that's not the most interesting thing about him. I just thought that was pretty cool.
That is the most interesting.
That's amazing. That was my response to Emily. I mean, Stephanie, Emily, hello, hello. It's great to be here. And my response, he was like, wait, never flown a kite? Oh my gosh. Look, I this might sound silly, but like I've noticed that drugstore kites, like you're like Walgreens, CVS, those like $3.99, $4.99 kites that you see. Those are amazing at catching even the slightest of breeze. No joke. I don't know what it is about those things, but they're really easy to fly. So I highly suggest it. It's such an awesome experience to just catch some wind with a kite. It's just such a chill experience. But anyway,
I'll have to put that on the list of things to do. Totally. Yeah.
Totally. I used to do that as an adult. I mean, I haven't done it since I was a kid, but
You know, like in mindfulness sessions, when like the wise teacher is like talking about, you know, all the ways in which we can be present and all that wonderful stuff. And it's really hard to do. Like, I find that like flying a kite, I do that without thinking. I'm just like in the moment without even thinking. It's just like it's such a rad experience. So recommend it.
Yeah. Cool. So also, yeah, that's cool. Also a mindful experience. It's another thing to, another benefit other than it just being like a fun thing to do.
Totally.
Everything has a little bit, you know, of a mental health benefit to it, I think. So, but yeah, thank you so much for being here. And I actually forgot to say, he works with Mind Chicago, and we've had some guests from Mind Chicago on here, and we have a few more scheduled. So like, you guys are really awesome over there. You just have so many clinicians and practitioners that are doing great things. And we're glad that you guys want to be a part of our podcast and talk about these issues. We really, really appreciate it. So
yeah. And Mind Chicago has been very supportive on Instagram as well. Yes. which is very appreciated.
So check them out. They're of course in Chicago. But if you're in Illinois, I believe Abbas is taking, you know, willing to see clients within the state. So if you want to look him up, you can on Mind Chicago's website. And we'll link all of that in the Instagram. But anyways, let's get to our topic at hand. So because you have a master's in divinity and an LCSW, and you're, you know, kind of a part of both of those worlds, can you first tell us just a little bit how you got into going for a master's of divinity, and then that transition into clinical social work and therapy?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, some of these this origin story goes mm-hmm. kind of far back when I think about it. When I trace back how it is that I kind of stumbled into a career as a chaplain, I think back to a really important phone call I had when I was finishing undergrad, and I was kind of trying to figure out, well, okay, what do I want to do next, right? And I was thinking back to an experience I had when I was in fourth grade. Back when the Children's Hospital in Chicago was in Lincoln Park, before it was Lurie Children's, it was, I was a pediatric patient back there when I was in fourth grade. And I was in the ICU for a couple of weeks and, you know, recovering after that for a number of weeks after that. Had just some really powerful experiences being cared for by strangers, right? Just this talented medical team, nurses and doctors just pouring their hearts out into their patients, really impacting families and people like me. You know, I just really was just so impacted. I remember as I was finishing my healing at the Children's Hospital and was able to kind of like walk around the neighborhood. You know, I had an IV pole and everything, was kind of like walking around, beautiful day. I had a really powerful conversation with my dad. He said, "Hey, Abbas, you know, the folks here in this community, they've given you a lot." I was like, "Yeah." It's like, "You know what that means, right? It means that one day you have to give back." And I, you know, I'm a fourth grader. I'm like, is that how it works? Okay. You know what I mean? I guess, sure. Okay. You know, so like that moment really, really stuck with me, you know? And so here I am, fast forward a number of years later, had some really cool experiences with science along the way, get to undergrad, learn about religious studies, learn about really awesome things like anthropology, biology, just ecology, learning some really great stuff. I'm like, well, what do I want to do with my life? So all of this stuff is cooking. I make this phone call to the Children's Hospital and I speak to someone in the volunteer department. I said, "Hey, I was a patient there, and the volunteers that came and visited with me and played board games with me and just had normal conversations with me, like, that was so important. Like, that made me feel like a human being, you know. That made it was so important. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. The person on the other line was like, well, it sounds like you want to be a child life specialist or a chaplain. And I'm like, what is that? So transferred me to a chaplain who was working at the hospital. And I had a really lovely conversation. Person said, you know, we give presence, you know, we give active listening, right? We give non-judgmental, non-anxious space for people to just express themselves. And I was like, yes, 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 yes. I want to do that. I want to do that. Can I volunteer for you? And he said, nope, we don't take volunteers. You have to go through this training. And I was like, well, tell me about that. And that kind of launched me into something called CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. And that is a really neat way about reflecting on one's own self and also reflecting on what it means to be in service of others, especially in the scope of spiritual care. Had some really great mentors and some really great experiences, but that really kicked it off. I started the training and when the unit was finished, I wasn't. So I did more, you know, I just kept doing more. And that just snowballed into practicing as a chaplain. And it just so happens, if you want to become a board certified chaplain, or if you want to like progress in this career path, a master's in divinity is something that's really helpful. And so that I was like, well, what's that? That sounds like a Harry Potter Hogwarts like degree, like master's in divinity. What is that? Like, am I going to be learning some cool spells? Are you sure? You know, no, it actually turns out like divinity school is full of really brilliant minds who approach religion and spirituality with a variety of lenses: history, psychology, anthropology, right, sociology, philosophy. And so my world just kept on expanding and getting enriched. And divinity school eventually turned into social work school a few years later. So there's a lot of stuff that's been cooking. So it's been a really great ride so far.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that. That's amazing. And I can tell you're super passionate about it. Just the way you talk about it, like you really love and are passionate about this. So that's amazing.
I mean, look, being a chaplain, being a therapist, we get to be present to some amazing, amazing life moments, mm-hmm. Stories that sometimes we're the only ones who hear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say this with all the absolute care in my heart, but like, I can't believe I get paid to do this job. Like, really, like, it's amazing. It's like the best seat in the house for humanity, like the episodes of humanity to unfold. It's like the best show. It's like such a cool experience to have this like personal connection, these intimate moments unfold. I can't believe that I get to do this and call it work, you know? So yeah, you better believe I'm passionate about it. I have fun with it like every day. Yeah.
I love that. I love your love and your excitement for it. And you're right. That connection, it both for therapists and chaplains, priests, you know, anyone in that sort of role is, I mean, it's such a, there's so much responsibility with that when people are coming to you and opening up and sharing very intimate moments, just you and them and, you know, their vulnerability and trusting you to keep them safe in those moments. And so you're right. It's beautiful to have that sort of responsibility and that people would trust you with that. And it makes sense now, you know, that you've talked about it, that getting that master's in divinity it probably was a very, well, maybe it wasn't easy to then go in, get another master's, but it seems like a natural sort of progression of master's in divinity and to go into, you know, therapy or social work, even especially because there's all those different approaches that you get in social work, people approaching issues and topics from, you know, from different points of view. And it's not just a, okay, we're just going to look at the person or the brain or what's going on with them. We're looking at every other part of them as well.
It is such a neat thing of social work that mm-hmm. we are really, I think, nimble at switching the lenses up. And in fact, we like make it a point of pride to carry multiple lenses in our toolkits all the time. Like, look how good we are at doing this, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an absolutely tremendous, tremendous part of this field for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this gives you, because that's definitely a lens, like spirituality and divinity, it's definitely a lens that I don't have, you know, so it gives you kind of like another lens to look at things from and kind of help the client see things through that lens.
Is that? Yeah. You know, I think that's like a really good point, Emily, you know, as nimble as we are as social workers in the field, one thing that I have noticed, and I don't know if this is just anecdotal, some of my colleagues have also noticed this too, that that social workers sometimes seem hesitant or averse to talking about things related to spirituality or mm-hmm. religion when it comes to their clients or the populations they serve, you know, and that's always been kind of a point of curiosity. I don't know if either of you have noticed this, or I don't know, Emily, you kind of said that that's not really a lens that I have. You know, I'm kind of curious if you all have noticed this or what it was like for you when you all were getting trained. Were there courses offered in spirituality and religion, or what was that like?
Not that I remember. I didn't remember it. But no, I don't think there was. There was the, of course, like, especially in social work, there was a lot of like cultural competencies and that sort of word being thrown around. And I think they kind of incorporated spirituality and religion into that, but it was not a focus, if I remember, you know. And our grad school was interesting, I thought, in that there were people of so many different religious identities and practicing faiths. And so it was cool when we had discussions that, you know, everyone was coming from a different perspective and you got to hear that, but there wasn't really a focus on mm-hmm. on that in the studies, at least, right, Emily? I don't remember.
No, I mean, and if there were, I didn't have space in my schedule. Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have something, because I've definitely come across situations where my clients are talking about it. And, you know, when Stephanie said that you grew up among Jewish people, and I did this, like, I don't know if you know, I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish, but I grew up Reformed Jewish, but I consider myself culturally Jewish. I'm not super spiritual. So I do find that I get a little bit, like, I'm not always sure how to respond. Like when my clients are talking about their spiritual beliefs. So I would have loved to have more training in that.
You know, especially there are these moments also in therapy sessions where maybe we notice like our clients have like overly identified with us, you know, like, for example, if like a client maybe is like, oh, well, you're Jewish, so you must know, or like, you're Jewish, so you must do X, Y, and Z, right? Like I do. And it's like, oh, hang on a second, actually, like, not very religious here, you know what I mean? Or you actually described I think you used the word, I'm not spiritual, right? In that sense, right? That's an interesting thing too, is I've noticed that social workers in particular are quite a passionate bunch, right? Like we really believe in the things we believe, like with our fiber and with our bones, like the fiber of our bodies and the bones of our bodies, you know what I mean? And the work, the type of work that we do and the amount that it means to us, right? I feel, and I'm biased, obviously I'm super biased, but like, I really do think social workers are a passionate bunch. And I am going to go out on a limb here. And I would say the work of social workers can be spiritual for that person. Maybe they wouldn't call it that, but I guess now that kind of brings us into like, how are we defining these terms? Like what is a religion? What is spirituality? What does that even mean to, you know? So I get it. Maybe you're not spiritual in like the traditional Jewish sense, right? When it comes to like practicing of certain rituals or something, maybe, I don't know, but I don't know. Like I give social workers the benefit of the doubt and I see them as spiritual creatures because of the amount of passion and the type of work, the type of engagement. Like you go home and yeah, you try to leave, you know, you try to leave the parts of work at work, you know, and go home and be present to other parts of your life and everything. Correct me if I'm wrong, but social workers bring that stuff home and sometimes a really helpful way, continue the conversation, spread the education, right? Keep those flames of passion stoked in helpful ways, you know, not necessarily being letting things dominate us at home or anything, but, you know, the topics of conversation still seem substantive amongst my colleagues and I, even when we're off the clock, if you
even
will.
Even when you're doing a podcast to talk about these things and you're not at work. Yeah. No, I'm completely resonating with what you're saying because sometimes like Emily and I, when we hang out with our other social work friends or even just the two of us, especially, and we start getting into some really heavy conversations. And sometimes she's like, okay, we're not at work. Can we just talk about something light, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. We're like getting into it, you know? But yeah. 'Cause you're right. There is this, you live it. I mean, you see how these different systems affect your clients and you empathize with them and you connect with them and it changes what you believe. I mean, I went through that experience in grad school. I thought I knew what I believed and I believed one way and that's how I always grew up. And then through those 3 years of grad school, I was like, no, I believe something almost entirely different than the rest of my family. And I've never thought about it being spiritual in that way. It really just like, I mean, you've like kind of blown my mind a little bit because I've never considered that. Like just personally, I grew up in a very conservative sort of fundamental New Testament Christian church. And we went to church on Sundays, every Sunday until I was 18 years old and every Wednesday until I was 18 years old. And I taught Bible classes there and I volunteered there. I even went on a quote unquote mission trip when I was 18. And I really thought, you know, I just really believed in what I was doing. And then some things had changed and my faith started to change. And not only did my like political and social beliefs change, but I just changed into this. I was like, you know what? I don't actually believe this anymore. I think I'm an atheist. And now that's how I identify. But so when you're atheist, there is sort of a lot of well, no, I'm not spiritual at all. You know, this sort of like, no, I'm not spiritual. I don't do anything spiritual. Everything I do is very secular and like, but that's not really true. I do a lot of things that aren't, are based on faith of different, you know, not so much faith in maybe in God, but faith in other things. And, and then you're right with this work that is spiritual. That is it's a spirituality that I just never, so I'm sorry. I'm having like this internal thought. You've just opened up.
I had that reaction too. I was like, huh. Okay. So yeah, I mean like as far as like I don't really pray, and I don't, you know, have a strong like connection with God, but yeah, I could tell you really what when you said like, how are we defining these words? Like, how are we defining spirituality? That is really interesting. And yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts of that, because I can tell you have something you want to say.
I love Stephanie, that you went there and you were like, wait, was that movement in my life of body and mind, that transformation of thought and belief, could we call that spiritual?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it, but like truly
like that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, like the type of work that we do as therapists, as in the helping profession, right? We meet people where they're at. Now, that's risky. It's risky. You know why? Because we risk being utterly transformed by our encounters. We risk entering one person and leaving forever different, right? Just one encounter, right? That's that transformative stuff. I don't know that I have words for it all the time, but that feels really spiritual to me. Acknowledging that maybe the moments are, we're in transition, like nothing is like permanent, this sort of like transient nature that we're existing in, like the connections that form and then dissipate. Being alive, breathing, being a creature that thinks and breathes, right? Being alive, responding to your environment without even thinking, without even meaning to do so, responding to others, responding to animals, other life forms. Like, I can't get away from the sense that there is no difference between science and spirituality. I can't get away from the sense that even ordinary, so-called ordinary, mundane moments don't possess some amazing, unknown, mysterious qualities, maybe until they're examined and brought to awareness and known. Maybe they're still mysterious, maybe less so, but like this whole process of being so engaged with experience and life, all of that feels spiritual to me. I know that sometimes life is so busy and the notifications are popping, right? And the screens are 3 and 4 at a time, right? And sometimes it doesn't feel like there's a lot of enchantment or mystery anymore. And in fact, I say, wait, there's even more than before. I don't know how any of this stuff works, but it does, right? Like I think about how therapy in person is this time-honored tradition of humans meeting in the flesh, in the same space, communing together, talking with one another, sharing some deep stuff, right? And there's this, like, if you think about it as a patient, if you're a patient and you're in therapy, think about the process that is involved in joining the session. Maybe you have to get into your car and drive somewhere and you transition. You're in this liminal space, right? Where you're going someplace, you know? Maybe you're firing up Zoom, maybe all of a sudden across distances eliminated is another face, a caring face. That seems kind of like magic to me in just a different form. Mm-hmm. So I think these ways to shift our perception of what's happening around us right now, just that ability to be flexible in that moment and shift perspective, whew, that feels spiritual to me. Now, I personally am not very religious. You know, I'm just not. You know, when I was a chaplain, the only times I would really pray were when I had to with my patients, and had to is not the right word to use. It was actually quite an absolute privilege to do so. But it was not part of my personal way of expressing my spirituality. give me a kite, give me that $4.99 drugstore kite, put that in my hand, give me a, just even Stephanie, even just the slightest breeze, seriously, just the slightest, and just give me that experience. And you know, that to me is very powerful. You know, that to me is
having a good.
Just gonna say, like, I may not be praying with words in a certain way, unless I'm doing it with like a patient or something, but I don't know. Is that a form of prayer? having a moment, flying a kite, just having a moment and being present to it. I don't know. What are some of your thoughts? I see you've got some.
I'm having a moment right now. I think we both are.
We are.
This is like kind of mind blowing because these are, because you're right. Like those are such powerful moment. Like even just the way you described getting on a Zoom call with your therapist, like you just like log in and there's a caring face on the other side of the screen. Like, you know, it's just like these things that are just so mundane, like getting in a car or getting on the train or the bus or whatever, and going somewhere. Like that is a, even if you're going to your therapist appointment or you're going to like somewhere healing, like even, you know, for me, I'm very extroverted and like meeting friends is very healing for me. Like, am I like entering like a spiritual journey, just like hopping on the train to go meet friends for a drink? I mean, maybe, you know, and that's a perspective I never thought of before. It's just, it to me, these things have always, you know, you just get in your, you know, your routine and kind of adding like this, it's sort of like you're sprinkling in this, like spiritual, you use the word magical, like component to like your day-to-day tasks, and that you have a different perspective on it once you do that.
And that totally, it is kind of like our humans have this really cool ability to sprinkle, to do that kind of sprinkling, you know. We have this amazing ability to choose. Right. And so I think with becoming aware of a moment or a reality as it's unfolding gives us space to do a sprinkle. You know, what is that sprinkle that makes your life meaningful? What is that move? What is that substance that you're gonna like add, that like special spice? Because you have the ability to sprinkle. You know, like humans are such amazing creatures, right? We can have an experience and almost simultaneously become aware that we're having that experience. You know, it's this wild, wild opportunity we all have, right? And so I love that you're thinking about sprinkling magic in a moment, because I do think we have that ability to infuse so-called ordinary moments with something special, or simply just to acknowledge, just to really just acknowledge that a moment is happening. Ah, that's really special to me. When you talked about getting on the train to go visit friends, is that a spiritual, like, am I entering into like a mini pilgrimage there? You know, I got goosebumps. I don't know. I mean, I think that when human beings make contact with what means the most to us, our values, and this is me, this is my, you know, ACT and DBT training coming out, you know, giving me the language for this. But truly, when we make contact and we're able to move towards those values, isn't that a life worth living? Right? Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, I'm sort of like, as you're talking, I'm thinking back to just what I remember from church. And I'm, of course, they said something like this a lot, but I know there are other religions that it's similar, where, because in the New Testament, it says where two or more of you meet, you know, I am there. And that's fellowship, is just a group of people that believe in the same thing, spending time together. And so really, when you're with your friends or colleagues, and you all share a similar belief or purpose, or even just a connection, like that's a fellowship in a way. I mean, that's a worship of, you know, of some kind. And so, I mean, that's just, that is so interesting to sort of look through that lens. Again, like we said, we don't do that, but now you've sort of opened up this, like, okay, well, now we can consider things a little differently. And what that might be like for our clients. And I do have a question about, so you said, you know, as your work as a chaplain, you prayed with clients, and I'm sure, because from just what I know of chaplain work, a lot of times you're probably called because this is someone's, you know, they're dying. And so they're wanting some prayer, and they're wanting some, maybe a service or some worship or something. And so, I mean, spirituality, I've noticed with my clients, comes up the most when we talk about death and grief. And so it, there's this, I mean, of course, there's this just connection of spirituality and death, because it's like, all right, well, what happens after we die? That's what everyone wants to know. We've always wanted, been concerned about that as humans. And it's also a way that people cope with grief. So can you talk a little bit about that and that experience, and also how that has helped you as a therapist, and I'm sure seeing clients with grief, you just have a different way of maybe looking at that and helping them with that.
Yeah. It's no surprise that things like religion, spirituality show up in those times of stress, or even end of life. That does seem to be somewhat of a trend. So given that chaplains do indeed show up for end of life services. I've had many an interesting, powerful conversation with folks who are at death's doorstep, right? Like the ultimate mystery, right? Like sometimes we don't get to cross that threshold with awareness, right? Sometimes we're, well, not that we can tell sometimes, right? If you're like in a medically induced coma, for example, if you've lost certain faculties, for example, as the body is shutting down, there are other times where folks get kind of close to death and they are still able to kind of communicate and ask questions, make statements, make opinions, you know, last wishes, all sorts of really amazing. I've had the privilege to bear witness to many amazing things like that. When folks want a ritual or a prayer or like a little service, one of the first things that I ask, like say, for example, if someone requested a prayer of me or from me or with me, and say, well, would you like to lead or should I? Like that's my first, that was always kind of my standard first question. Would you like to lead or should I, you know? And more often than not, it's people wanted me to say a prayer, right? Totally understandable. Other times in some opportunities, some folks saw that as an opportunity to have a prayer in a prayerful space. And so they actually like led the prayer. And, you know, oftentimes if the person was comfortable, they're hold a hand or hold hands. The second question I would ask is, what can we pray for? What should I pray for? What would you like to pray for? It's kind of in that vein, because I don't want to ever presume to know, you know? And so it's so interesting to kind of lead by following, right? And I don't think therapists do something very dissimilar either. I think we do something really similar. Is we will lead, and it's a collaborative lead. It's a total, like you tell me what's important to you, and we're gonna get there together. And it's that kind of spirit that is channeled in that moment, you know. Sometimes you get an opportunity to have a relationship with someone more than just that, like one sort of like final prayer or maybe like a final ritual. Maybe you're actually lucky enough to have visited with that patient or family on a number of times, or maybe even for weeks, you know, and it can really make the moment so powerful. It's just like amazing to see family members show up for this sort of makeshift ceremony, you know what I mean? Just like to fill a hospital room. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of instances where death happens in the wee hours of the morn when no one or very few are gathered. And the majority of people who are gathered are hospital staff, you know, your chaplain, your nurses, maybe a doctor or a resident, you know, someone will show up. I remember being paged. I was on call and I remember receiving a page at, you know, maybe it was about midnight. And the nurse gave me a heads up. She's like, "Hey, chap, we've got a patient here who's not doing so good. And there's a chance that the next time I page you, it's going to be because, you know, she will have died." And so I appreciate that nurse so much, just having the foresight to just kind of. So when I received the page again, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning and I was pretty sleepy, right? Had already had like many steps, many hours under that shift's belt. And so like feeling physically tired, right? And getting that page. And I just remember feeling the weight of like, oh, this young woman has passed away. And so I show up to the room and there's one family member gathered. There's an auntie gathered. And she informed me that it was important to the patient to receive a baptism. And this patient now is in a process that hospital would call actively dying, mm-hmm. right? Is like right there. It's the body is shutting down. There's some characteristic things to, you know, that inform someone that this is a body shutting down. Mm-hmm. And so that was happening and a baptism is being requested. And here I am, I'm not of the Christian faith, right? But I'm inhabiting this role as a chaplain. And so there are provisions in Christianity, for example, that allow someone who isn't a Christian to perform a baptism under emergent, you know, urgent situation, urgent circumstances. And so I happen to be the chaplain on call. I happen to be the one who is answering the situation's call. And so you can get like a little thing of sterile water from the unit on, you know, at the hospital there, right there, the nurse will bring you a little thing of water and have a little script of some things in the handy chaplain handbook. And what do you do except with script in hand and water in hand? What else do you do except, you know, you make the sign of the cross and with your pure intentions, with a heart that just wants to be present and serve, you say the words, right? And as I was saying the words, I remember, have you ever opened your eyes underwater, you know, like in a swimming pool? You can still mm-hmm. You can still see, right? You know, things kind of feel blurry and full. So I don't know if it was the lack of sleep or if I don't know if it was the power of the moment. I don't know. Those moments, they feel so, so full. They just are, I can't even describe it. It is an absolute just, it's awe. It's like feeling privileged. It's like feeling sad, feeling devastated. It's such a mixture of thoughts and emotions that show up when one walks into a room where death is near or death is, mm-hmm. and it just is, and it's there, you know? So although being a chaplain in a hospital does mean you get to be present to amazingly like joyous and healing moments, yes, part of the role does mean you will encounter death.
Yeah. And so how do you, I mean, I am, you know, I imagine like the social workers that go and work for like hospice, like I could never do that. That is just such a, such just an amazing thing if you're able to do that. So, you know, it must be similar, like coping with that yourself and, you know, having to deal with that as your job, but it's not just a job. It's affecting you. It's touching a part of you. And like you said, you're taking part of that with you all the time. So how do you cope with that? Or how did you cope with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great point. I think you are spot on that. The work that we choose to do, especially if it means a lot to us, it's going to have an impact on us, right? I remember walking out of a hospital room once after visiting with a patient, and the nurse outside said, "Oh, you were talking to that patient the entire time. You've been there for a while. I don't know how you do what you do." And I looked her straight in the eye. I'm like, "I don't know how you do what you do."
Yeah,
you know, like you're basically, you and your colleagues are responsible for running a hospital. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like you can't have I don't care how many doctors you have. You can't have a hospital without nurses.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're just like, you can't, like they are sometimes wrist deep in a lot of, a lot of intensity, right? On their feet, right? For 12 hours plus, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I don't know how you do what you do, right? So you're right. The stuff that we choose to do, especially if we put our whole body, mind, right? Mm-hmm. Passion into it, it is going to take a toll. So thankfully, when I was a chaplain, I was younger. I think there's like some resilience that comes with like being in your 20s, I suppose. That kind of helped. You can't do it alone though. Definitely was really privileged to have an awesome mentor, and receive like lots of meaningful consultation, right? So there's this, you never really feel totally alone, mm-hmm. even though the job does have these like lone wolf aspects to it. But really connecting with things that restore you, like speaking of myself, like I'm surprised we've talked about kites so much, but I do remember like making my way out more than one occasion after a tough or long shift at the hospital and just flying a kite, right? Just doing something like that, just doing something on purpose that is restorative. There was a point where I went through really appreciating delicious food, like just flavors of food that I never thought to make myself or never really imagined combinations of. So really really paying attention to just how it feels as I take that bite, you know, mm-hmm. Putting on a song that I know really speaks to me on purpose, like really putting it on purpose and being with it. Like these moves, they have this sort of collective impact, and sometimes it's not enough. So burnout's a real thing, especially, you know, in situations like, I don't know, a global pandemic. I can imagine that people who are in these forward-facing healing professions, that yeah, we're all feeling the impact right now. So the basics go a long way, right? The things like the things that you feel passionate about, and if they so happen to be things that like nourish you, like food, you know, wonderful, you know, things like music, things like arts, being active with the body, going for that walk. For no other reason other than just to get the body moving, you know? So things like that really, really helped me, helped sustain me and still do to this day. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so sort of what you were saying before as well, like taking those, like with eating the food and really enjoying it and paying attention to it. And like, that's a very mindful moment, and so is flying a kite, and this mindfulness has kind of been a theme here, but I mean, that's okay. So the thought that's coming to my mind is a lot of the newer interventions and modalities that therapists are starting to use, like DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, and ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, are based on very spiritual ideas. And a lot of the interventions are from that, taken from that. It may be even a little appropriated from that, you know, especially like with like meditation and a lot of like Buddhist beliefs about the world and about yourself and being a part of the world. And so, I mean, there's, yeah, it's sort of, it's in, I mean, there's science behind those things, right? It's evidence-based, but we took those things, those interventions from faith, from religion. And we were like, hey, that's working for people. Why does that work for people? And it's like that saying when you said, you know, everything's a little bit magic, like it's magic until you know how it works. So it seems like magic until you know how it works. And then it's, mm-hmm. you know, magic is just what we don't understand it yet, but we know it works. We just don't understand how it works.
Interesting. I love that. Magic is magic until it's just then science or something, mm-hmm. right? You know, yeah. I think there is something to that. yeah, it's definitely like a wonderful place to be, like informed by sort of the training as a chaplain, now being present to children, families, young adults. It's one thing I've noticed is my younger clients and just children in general are so good at being in the moment, are so good at being mindful. They're just like naturally, I don't know, just like pros when you think about how in the moment they are and just how honest they are with their feelings and thoughts. Totally.
That's true. Just, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a really neat place to be right now. I'm really grateful. Yeah.
And it's often seen as a negative thing to be like, you know, you have like reckless teenagers or just like people who are just like not overthinking and they're just like living their best life, which is seen as negative. And it's like, they're like put down for that, you know? And sure, like you do have to like keep yourself safe and like maybe thinking through certain things a little more, like is a good skill, but also like there should be more push to like maintain that mindfulness that is natural to someone. It seems like with not a fully developed frontal lobe is like kind of like once you develop your frontal lobe, your like mindfulness abilities go down. Seriously, but there's also no push to keep it to keep that ability to be mindful, and there really should be.
You know, you're onto something with that, Emily. I think more adults do need to get back into like the sandbox. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that's like literally, maybe we need sandboxes on our workforce.
Yeah, there's sand track therapy. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But, you know, that's the other interesting thing is the opportunity that technology affords us to experience, I don't know, spirituality, but also experience things like self-care and connection. Just being able to, for example, fire up a virtual simulation or a video game with someone, maybe it's with a patient, maybe it's with one of your friends or a family member, but even though you're not sharing the same space, sharing the same time with that shared platform, I think can afford for a really powerful connection too. So it's just such an amazing time, I think, to kind of be a human. It's not without its challenges, though, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true. We're in the middle. I mean, well, we always are in the middle of history, but definitely right now it feels like this is the middle of history. Like they're going to teach this, you know, to our great grandkids. Like The plague of 2020.
There's something when I was in undergrad and was doing religious studies, one thing that I kind of learned is like that a lot of people through time think they're living in the end of times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just been kind of a common theme for all of recorded human history. There's always been some group saying that this is the end of time, right? I mean,
one day someone will be right, but
yeah, right. No, but until then, we're in the middle of it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, what sort of social justice stuff comes up in your work that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Check your privilege. Check your privilege. Check your privilege. Right. Like, absolutely. So I think about, for example, to spend time doing and talking about spirituality, to me, implies that maybe we have some of our real basic life survival things in check, right?
Right.
There are, yeah. I think, folks out there who aren't able to connect with or make contact with meaningful aspects of humanity because they, for example, don't have the privilege of time and space to do so, right? So I think we can notice how even within spiritual practice that there can be this sort of privilege that mm-hmm. exists.
Mm-hmm.
That's allowing us to, you know, cultivate and make contact with these facets of humanity. Not everyone gets to do that. Not everyone has the opportunity to do that. So that can show up in this work. And when I sort of encounter folks who like haven't had the opportunity to engage in things like creativity and just for the sake of being creative, right? Because like I would consider creative pursuits and to be spiritual pursuits, they're transformative, they're powerful, they're significant. And there's so many folks who don't have that opportunity. So, you know, it's something that when I encounter, it really does sort of, it's a privilege check moment. You know, that I've been really lucky to be able to spend some time and energy in this field, right? Yeah, that's one thing that comes to mind. I don't know if you all have some thoughts on that too. But this is a really neat, I think, intersection of conversation, social justice and spirituality, because spirituality, I think, you know, for example, I'm thinking about how religion or spirituality can be both, depending on the perspective or the situation, something that furthers betterment and also can be something that prevents it too.
Right.
Let me give you an example. For example, in the Hindu tradition, the Ganges River is sacred. Okay. So does that mean that we should absolutely like leave it as it is because it's a sacred thing and that's not in the realm of human beings? It's in the realm of another realm, the divine realm, something else, right? So nope, not our business here, right? So does that mean that the pollution levels of the Ganges should be ignored, like the environmental impacts and the health impacts? I don't know, right? Or does it mean that since it is a sacred aspect, doesn't that mean we should take care of it, right? So you see how spirituality or religion, depending on kind of how we approach it or how we wield it, can be actually used for social justice, right? It can be used for become something that like can be an obstacle to it too, mm-hmm. right? So.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's a lot of good that is being done in the world by religious organizations and groups, and there's also a lot of oppression that's being done as well by similar groups. So you're right. There's not just one side of the coin. There's, mm-hmm. I think it's with everything, because people are involved, we muddle it and make it more complicated than it needs to be. Just depending on who's behind it or who's leading it or their own biases can really affect and change the message of whatever they're trying to get across, even if it's the same message. Like you look at just within the Christian faith alone, like there are so many different denominations. They're all following the same God. They all believe in Jesus Christ, as their savior, and believe in the Bible. But then that's about where the similarities end, because everyone has a different interpretation of that scripture. And I'm sure that's not unusual, for other religions as well. It's just, I know Christianity more intimately, but reading one verse changes, different people interpret it different ways and use that for different things. It's okay to do this. It's not okay to do this. We have a moral, obligation to do this. We shouldn't interfere in this, sort of like you were saying. So,
yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Religious texts and doctrines have often historically been generated by men, have been generated by the elite of society, mm-hmm. right? So there's no way this stuff isn't trickling down, right? I mean, like it is, right? We can see it in the way that leadership is, what are they comprised of? What are the values, right? We can see that there are some unhelpful trends that still remain, right? Whether they're in individual practice or in captured in systems too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's definitely a good point, looking at where this stuff comes from and how it applies, made by the male white elite of society, and then applying that to, a broader range of people is definitely something worth noting. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you wanted to share with us? Because we're approaching the end, but have a couple more minutes.
Well, I'm just kind of reminded by just sort of what happened earlier in our conversation when we just kind of invited up the perspective of those powerful moments in our life or those powerful stories that really we just are always going to hold on to. I would invite folks to revisit those moments, revisit those stories, wonder if some of the transformation and change that those memories and stories capture, could those be thought of as spiritual movements in a human life? I mean, religion aside, right? Mm-hmm. Belief in a theistic entity, not required, just reflecting on just the absolute amazingness of being just being a human in this world. And I think, I don't know, I think there's something really special that we all got to kind of participate in that conversation, just questioning, wondering, right? Yeah. And it's in that sort of space that I would love folks to kind of revisit aspects of their life and wonder, have I been a spiritual creature this whole time?
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, it was eye-opening, but you're right. There's, it's not, religion and spirituality, do not have to be together. Like you can be spiritual without religion, and you can be spiritual without a belief in a higher power. So I think that's an important thing to also just sort of take away, because definitely my sort of bias is always thinking of spirituality as being connected to religion. And really, I have my own trauma with religion, but not spirituality. So that is a place that I can continue to explore. And maybe if people are listening to this and they have similar religious trauma, you can still explore spirituality and be a spiritual being without having, you know, to be religious or be connected to whatever, you know, religion it was that caused that trauma for you. So I think that's a great thing to point out and just sort of leave people with.
Yeah, definitely a big takeaway from this discussion. Thanks for opening our eyes to that idea.
This has been wonderful to have you on. I mean, thank you again so much for taking time out of your day and sharing your experiences and some of your expertise with us and just your thoughts. And this has been a wonderful discussion. And I hope everyone listens to this episode, especially. I just feel like there's going to be a lot that so many different people can get out of it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's definitely a unique topic. We haven't had a topic like this at all, like even remotely related to this.
Yeah.
So I was looking forward to having you for that reason. And I think this will definitely resonate with a lot of our listeners. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah. Well, that's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow us on wherever you get your podcast. And we'd also appreciate a rating and review.
And don't forget to follow the show's Instagram for updates on new episodes at Just Mental Health Podcast. And that is with a period between each of those words. We record a new episode, as I was going to say every week, but really just as often as we can. So this is Stephanie.
And Emily.
And a boss.
Signing off. Thanks for listening.